Now, you had a compliment of sorts, I think, from Epic Records stating how quickly you recorded those songs for the album.
Yeah, we never thought of ourselves as recording fast. I mean, it was natural to us. We didn't even know we were doing that fast, but they would tell us that Barbra Streisand was pretty hard to work with, and it took her a whole day, if not more, to record one song. They loved Peter, Paul, and Mary, but they said it took them a whole day to record one song. But we were just, like, knocking out the songs, and so they finally just had a, you know, comment to us. They said we were all like computers and so well prepared that we always had extra songs in what they called in the can. So when they were putting an album together, you know, they were choosing a lot of extra songs. What 12 songs did they want to choose out of what was there to choose from?
And off this album, Epic releases a 45, right?
They released, let me see, Shenandoah on one side, and Pretty Girls and Rolling Stones. There's that mystery writer again. Shenandoah backed with Pretty Girls and Rolling Stones. Both were pick hits in Cashbox, and Shenandoah was receiving airplay in five major markets, including St. Louis, Missouri, where it was actually topped I Want to Hold Your Hand. It played for a month just above the number two song. It was number one over I Want to Hold Your Hand. And from what we heard in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they were playing it in the drive-in theaters, Shenandoah.
Interestingly enough, the same month that the Goldbriars' first album is released just happens to be the first month when the Beatles arrive from England and play on Ed Sullivan.
Right. Who would believe that, you know, the guys with their, now they had black turtlenecks, black pants. They had like a, I don't know if you call it like a tunic shirt dyed different colors over the top of the black turtleneck. They had black boots on. They had black hair. And our hairdos were, of course, long after, you know, we had the ratted hairdos in the beginning. Toward the beginning in the Lazoo Coffee House, we did other shows, and one was with the 17 models at Dayton department store. And the models had these straight, kind of like a bobbed to-do, hairdo. And Sherry and I immediately had our hair cut like that. So after that, our hair was always, you know, straight. It was a total simple other looks. So you've got the Beatles with their black boots, their black image, and we're in New York City looking just like the Beatles. The Beatles took off. They were the craze, and New York City was an awfully big town and commercial market, and people would think that we had something to do with the Beatles because of our image. Who would have thought the same week our album came out, the Beatles, a beginning hit in the United States. It was just very unique and very strange.
At some point here, the band and John Haney part ways.
I never was involved in the business, the money, the this or that, but Kurt was meeting with other high people in booking companies and our record top people, and there to be some falling out with our manager. What was said and what happened, you know, I know what was said. I'm not really sure, even though I have noted it. Anyway, he was parted from our group. So John Haney actually went on in life, and from the Goldbriars, he was an engineer for Judy Collins, and if you look him up, H-A-E-N-Y, he did a lot of things with other groups, but for some reason he was not the best for the Goldbriars, and we were told to part ways with him, so we did.
And you sign up with a large New York City booking company, ITA.
ITA, yes, and the first club they booked us at was at the New York Blue Angel Club. I mean, this was like really top-notch, prestigious, popular club. I'm sure we were all nervous, but we had already performed a lot before. But I remember going in there, and it was really dark, you know, with the spotlight on the stage. So you got the stage, and you really know that you are, nobody's eating. It's just a stage where they come to see you and review your act. So we did a good job, and we felt very proud of ourselves, but it was so dark in there. When we left, we were supposed to go off stage. I went the wrong direction. I'm the only one that went the wrong direction. I actually walked right into a wall, and I couldn't find my way out. Somebody had to come and guide me to where the exit was. It was that dark up there, but people were laughing. The guys thought it was, you know, Ron and Kurt thought it was hilarious, but I was a little bit embarrassed, to say the least.
What was your impression of this new agency with all these executives in suits?
They were the top of the cream of the crop in New York City, and when we met with them, you know, the people behind the desk were smoking cigars, and I mean, it was like going into a movie set. It didn't even seem real to Sherry and I. We just like, oh my gosh, you know, is this a movie, or are these actually people that we're going to work with? So we joked around with them. They said to Sherry and I very seriously, oh, I guess you two are sisters. And Sherry and I said, no, we're brothers, you know, and they didn't expect that. And so they were choking on their cigars. We thought it was pretty funny, but we did break the ice. So, no, but they were great. And they told us that they thought we could be the next hit after Peter, Paul, and Mary that they also managed.
Now, I understand at the Cellar Door in Washington, D.C., you meet Gail Garnett and her bass player, Keith Olson. And down the road from the Cellar Door is a club called The Shadows, where you also meet some people who are in the, well, folk pop business.
Right. By this time, we are folk pop. We're definitely not just folk. And our sound had evolved to give us a pop flavor. We performed at the Cellar Door. Gail Garnett had just been there, and we got to see her last couple performances. And we met her and her bass player, Keith Olson. In between our sets, just down the street, was a club. Now, the Cellar Door is like a folk club, but we were folk pop, but we still fit in. And down the street was a club called The Shadows, and it was a little bit more lively. You could drink there, and now the Cellar Door, I don't remember them serving any beer or liquor or anything. So on our breaks, we would go down the street to The Shadows, and there we met a number of popular folk bands, including members who were in a folk band called the Mugwumps, Cass Elliott. Let me see. There was Cass Elliott and Zal Janowski were in the Mugwumps. They were in performing at the Shadows. And there were also John and Michelle Phillips and Denny Doherty. Sorry, got to have Denny Doherty in there. Yes, definitely. So we would go, and then after we all got done performing at the Cellar Door and they got done performing their sets at the Shadows, we'd go over there and we would all jam together.
There's an interesting quote from Kurt here. I think I'll read it. We were the beginning of the sound that became the Mamas and Papas. Our biggest fans were John Phillips, Cass Elliott, and Zal Janowski. Every time we played in the same town, they used to come and watch us, and many times we came to watch them. Cass and Zal were in the Mugwumps at the time. They would always ask us to come up and sing with them. Interestingly enough, when they put together the Mamas and Papas, they had the same kind of harmonies we had.
After our group broke up, Keith Olson was in our life at that point, and he and my sister got married, and Cass Elliott and Keith Olson were very good friends. They went to a show premiere in Hollywood, California. They went together. And by then, Mamas and Papas had formed to, you know, the members that we all know. Cass Elliott said to Keith, we took the Goldbrier sound. We stole their sound. I mean, we were no longer a group, so, and they admired our sound. So I guess we were a great inspiration for what their group became.
Now, looking at my notes, it states that the group was playing at various venues, and you came to realize that you were missing something on stage. What was it that you felt was missing?
We wanted to get ahead. Our sound was evolving. We decided we needed to evolve with our look a little bit more. Sherry and I needed to be a little bit more mod style. So Kurt's mom helped and designed and sewed us some long skirts. We had black turtlenecks and we had floor-length skirts. We also, in another one, had, I remember these light blue, they were like jumpers and black tights underneath and actually berets. We girls were wearing berets. Anyway, we had more of a mod style, and the guys had the tunics over their, still, the tunics over their black turtlenecks, black slacks, and black boots. By the way, the tunics were originally made out of Minnesota work shirts with the sleeves, and collars were cut off, and they were hemmed and dyed. That was pretty creative. That was Kurt's idea.
And is this the time period when you meet Bob Goldstein?
The Goldbriars in May of 64, we were back in New York City to record in May of 1964, and one thing we were missing, of course, was an act. You can only do so much with your natural personalities. You really, we were not talented in that area to write our own act. We were working on the music and our look. In May of 64, we checked into the Christopher Hotel in Greenwich Village. And by the way, the Christopher Hotel always had the H missing, so we always would joke it was the Christopher Hotel, and it was very cheap, you know, so of course they didn't have to put up the H. And we decided to, we needed an act, and the group, and added more complex instruments to our sound. Our second album had, we added like the vibes, the harpsichord. Well, in the first album was just the lead guitar and the rhythm guitar. It was lead or banjo and a tall bass. That was it with our voices. No other instruments. Second album, you've got those same instruments plus the vibes, harpsichord, tuba, drums, and timpani played by studio musicians. And that definitely rose us to a true level of the folk pop sound. For the second album, we decided that because of, we were tired of being called the Beatles, everywhere we went, oh, the Beatle image, you know, or are these somehow related to the Beatles? We decided to all bleach our hair blonde. The guys did not like how their hair turned out, so they dyed their hair black again. And so the second album cover has Sherry and I with blonde hair, and Kurt and Ron with black hair. We had long skirts made by, sewed and designed by Kurt's mom, and we just have a little bit more sophisticated look.
Okay, so your second album comes out in August 64. Would you like to read off the name of the 12 songs on that album?
Sea of Tears, McDougal Street, I've Got to Love Somebody, Jump Down, Sweet Potatoes, Haiku was written by Kurt, and Sea of Tears by Kurt and Bob Goldstein. No More Bomb, Queen of Sheba, Joy, 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 Castle on the Corner by Bob Goldstein, Zoom Golly Golly, and Ride That Chariot.
We should mention Beverly Ross at this point, too.
Bob Goldstein, of course he knew Beverly Ross because he and she were engaged at the time. And Beverly Ross was already a well-known writer. She wrote Judy's Turn to Cry, and I think she was a co-writer on Lollipop, Lollipop, and several other songs. Of course, Bob Goldstein became our manager at this point. They brought in a manager. Epic brought in a manager to give us an act to perform on the road after recording the second album. She wrote McDougal Street. Bob Goldstein wrote Castle on the Corner. And Bob Goldstein and Kurt wrote Sea of Tears, and actually they considered that my first solo. They said, we need to give Dottie bring her out, give her a little solo. So when they wrote that, it was so new, I was actually reading the lyrics in the recording studio. It was just reading and singing. Excited, you know, that I got to be featured a little bit.
Let's start with September 64 when Ron Nielsen leaves the group.
In September 1964, Ron Nielsen decides to leave the Goldbriars and go his own way. Kurt, Sherry, and I decided it was time to make another change in the group by adding more instruments and amplification. So it was pretty exciting. We added Tom Dorholt on the bass guitar. We auditioned, and Kurt met Tom Dorholt. He had a candy apple red bass, and then Murray Planta had been a a school friend of Ron's, and he joined us on the lead guitar. He was extremely talented and played the harmonica. And Ron Edgar joined us on the drums, and he was a perfect fit. And then Kurt decided to amplify his acoustic guitar with a microphone, and that created a more of a pop folk rock style, or we could just call it folk rock style for the group.
Okay, so this is a very major change for the group.
Right, but it was exciting because the group was fun and the music was fun, but when you're having that much fun, you don't mind having a little bit more fun by, you know, expanding. And Sherry and I had always done jazz pop together, so, you know, jazzing it up, so to speak, with folk rock was, you know, a wonderful idea. And there were other groups out there, there was other music out there that had good beats, that had a rock style beat. So, you know, we were trying to keep up with the times and be distinctive.
And it's Kurt who comes up with the idea for a gypsy image, correct?
Right. Kurt, because the way we traveled and, you know, we did fly a few times, but most of it was on the road, you felt like a gypsy. And for a while there, we had a gypsy wagon vehicle. And so Kurt decided that the guys would wear one earring. And it's really funny, as time went on, you know, who would have thought that almost everybody today, almost all the guys today have an earring, you know. So, but we didn't know that. It was to enhance our gypsy image.
Now, you have a very important job that comes along, and it's at 300 King Street in Charleston, South Carolina. How did that job come about, and what happened?
We had booking with our new agency in Winnipeg, Canada, but it was canceled, and so our booking agent called us and said we could go to 300 King Street in Charleston, South Carolina. And so we drove straight through because one was canceled. We hardly had enough time. We did the ride, the drive in 36 hours. We got there at the same time we needed to perform, so we were rather dusty and dirty, but we got ourselves together and got on stage, and we found out that the Wayfarers, a renowned folk group under RCA, owned the club, and that we were the first group besides them to perform there.
And in the Wayfarers is Sean Bonniewell.
Right. He was a guitar player and singer. I don't know if they had a leader, but anyway, he got to know our group. He was there along with one of the other members, and I don't even know who the other member was on that night to meet us, but Sean Bonniewell made himself well-known. He stayed in a place, you know, the third story is where he hung out and when the Wayfarers weren't performing.
And now at this club, you're trying out some of your new musical skits or comedy skits on stage.
Right. Bob Goldstein is with us. Not only is he a wonderful writer, he wrote novelty material. He put together our whole stage act. Our humor was actually sophisticated New York humor with novelty songs written by himself and some of his other friends, people that he knew from New York City. So our act was, we had a folk rock sound, a gypsy image, and we had a sophisticated humor, which people didn't always get, but, you know, in the beginning, we were just working all day or part of the day on the act, and then we were performing at night. It was like a steam room. We had to work real hard because we had to get our act literally together to be on stage and have something to present to the audience. And they decided they liked us, and we also had a comedy skit where they pulled some of Sherry's and my old songs, Mississippi Mud and Third Man Theme songs, where we did our duet in the old days, and we had fun with us, and the audience enjoyed watching us grow, and sometimes we stumbled along, but we had fun with it, and they liked it too.